The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Maya Nicholson, intern at Lawfare, with an episode of Rational Security from March 17th, 2024. For today's episode, the team at Lawfare decided to cross-post this week's episode of Rational Security, a roundtable podcast hosted by Scott R. Anderson, Quinta Jurassic, and Alan Z. Rosenstein, in which they discuss the week's top national security news stories. Today's episode is entitled The Sociopathic Nose Wrinkle Edition. In the episode, Anderson, Jurassic, and Rosenstein discussed President Joe Biden's State of the Union speech, the House's TikTok bill that aims to ban the app in the fall unless Chinese owners divest, the worsening situation in Haiti that awaits the ad hoc peacekeeping mission of 1,000 Kenyan police officers, and more. This is Rational Security.
Guys, I have big news. I think my heart has been taken by another. I thought about, a year ago now, that when I met Manic Pixie Jury Foreperson, that there was space for her. I had found the crazy media figure.
I forgot about her.
Oh, I mean, how could you?
I miss her. She was good.
I have her as my phone background because it's so entertaining.
Just replaced your wife and kid.
Oh, my gosh. They're on there, too. Don't worry about it. But, yes, our junior senator from Alabama really bring it hard for that jury for a person. I have to say, it is the somehow borderline sociopathic nose wrinkle that she pursued throughout the response that really just, I was like, this is something to behold. I've rewatched it twice now, and it's so worth it. It's just phenomenal.
It's some real theater kid energy.
Oh, it's beyond
physically
theater kid
painful
energy.
For me to watch. I watched like 30 seconds, and I had to turn it off.
It was just so breathy in Biden's America.
It's just
we know, guys. We know just what this is about. It's just ridiculous. It's amazing. That was what you kept saying over and over again.
This about her auditioning badly for Trump VP. I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think what do we know?
I don't know. That's just, she just kept saying we know.
Oh, I see. See, this is because I didn't actually watch the whole thing. Because
it was too painful. Your mistake. That is your mistake.
It's just weird because, you know, I then looked at some clips of her and she's like so, I mean, whatever politics aside, she's incredibly pleasant and normal sounding. She's like one of like the more, I think, like pleasing politicians. If you just listen to her, you're like, oh, wow, that is a normal person. And then like that happens.
There's a clip of her talking before she starts recording the speech where she basically says like, hi, everyone. Like, so excited to do the rebuttal of the State of the Union. Like, totally normal sounding. And yeah. Then she just became an insane person.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Rational Security. I am one of your regular co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson, thrilled to be back here in the virtual studio with my colleagues, Alan Rosenstein.
Hello.
And Quinta Jurassic, who's physically 5 feet away from me, 10 feet away from me, but with a wall.
Separated by several walls.
And as we could not get our sound set up quite to accommodate both of us here today at the office. How are you, Quinta?
I'm doing great.
Are you all ready to inherit the mantle, the ship of state that is Rational Security?
No.
With my departure? Do you have your puns and your planning documents ready?
No.
Because this is it, guys. This is it. I'm out of here after this for at least a month or two.
We are extremely screwed.
I am excited. I'm excited to be a listener.
We're going to take that ship of state and we're going to just plow it right into a sandbar.
There you go. I'm excited to be a listener and just complain about how fast you guys talk on Twitter, which is most of my reactions I get with our listener base. So exciting to have you leading the ship, so to speak.
Well, Scott, I mean, how are you feeling about your impending, I was going to say demise. No, that's right. About your impending demise.
It is kind of an impending demise. I have, you know, we have a baby arriving.
Can we make 2 months of jokes about how you died? Which is, I feel like, basically the jokes you all made about me.
In our defense, we very clearly said you didn't die because we realized we hit it too hard when you initially departed. And we were worried some people may think that's actually what happened. We have a baby coming in less than 48 hours. My house is full of contractors doing things to various corners of it, none of which seem like they can finish in 48 hours. Our house is a disaster because we had to empty all the things out of those rooms. So there's just a pile of stuff everywhere. So we're basically bringing the child home to like a large storage locker. But other than that, I think it'll be fine. I don't think she knows any different. So she'll feel very comfortable, I'm sure. Her eyes won't even focus like more than 10 feet away, I think, right, for the first couple of weeks. So if that far.
Thank goodness for that. I will be so curious when you get back to debrief. You and I should just do a – then you know what you should do? When you come back, you and I should just do a separate –
New dads.
New dads. No, new renewed dads.
Renewed dads edition. Oh, but I like
it. I'll be so curious like what your experience is, because for me it was a combination of, wow – the baby is so much easier the second time around because you're so much less freaked out. And also, net, this is definitely still more work than the first time. And I didn't have any bandwidth to spare. And it was like that combination of I'm less freaked out, but somehow even more tired than I was the first time around. That was an interesting combination.
Yeah, it's already feeling that way a little bit. And the baby's not even here yet. So we'll see how I feel when it arrives. But one thing I will not have to deal with, although it'll make me sad, I think, for the first couple of weeks at least, is that I will not have to deal with sitting with you fine people and our other colleagues to talk over the week's national security news. I'm just going to have to bore my wife with it and our children for the next few weeks. But that is okay because I get one last fill because we have a lot of national security news happening this week. We, of course, have one of the biggest events of the year in the State of the Union to talk over. So let us dig into it. We are calling in honor of our junior senator from the state of Alabama, the sociopathic nose wrinkle edition of Rational Security. Topic one, kitchen table issues. And I do mean issues. President Biden delivered a feisty State of the Union last week, one that took aim at both those worrying about his age and his apparent 2024 rival, former President Donald Trump. But what does his handling of key national security issues ranging from Ukraine to Gaza tell us about where the country is headed? And what can we gather from the response from the other party? Topic two, tick, tick, tick. The end may be nigh for TikTok, at least in the United States, at least in its current incarnation. The House has passed a bill as of today that would ban TikTok from app stores beginning in the fall unless its Chinese owners divest. Legislation that President Biden has said he will sign, but that former President Trump recently flipped on. Where is this new major social media platform headed, at least in the United States? And topic three, trying to stay alive. This is a somewhat dark reference to, of course, Wyclef Jean, the immortal rapper and Haitian politician.
Yikes.
Yikes. Policymakers are desperately trying to clear the domestic legal hurdles in both Kenya and the United States for an ad hoc peacekeeping mission to Haiti aimed at stemming the surge of gang violence there. But will the 1,000 Kenyan police officers set to be deployed be enough to restore peace and security to the country? For our first topic, Alan, let me hand it over to you to get us started.
So last Thursday, President Biden gave his State of the Union address. As Scott described at the top, it was, I think, feisty is actually a good way to describe it. A lot of jabs at President Trump, whom he called my predecessor. A lot of jabs at the Republicans there sitting in the audience. You know, I will use this as an opportunity, I think, as I always do when we talk about the State of the Union, to reiterate my objections to States of the Union. I know that it is in the Constitution. I do think a memo would be just fine. I hate States of the Union. I just don't like them. I've always disliked them. I especially don't like them in an election year because it's just a campaign speech. And I think this one, even more than most States of the Union, even more than most election year States of the Union, was just one long campaign speech. And as a campaign speech, I thought it was fine. I thought it was quite good. But I have always thought it strange that we gather the entire government together to listen to the president berate the other party and argue why he should be reelected. So again, down with States of the Union, a memo will suffice. Of course, no one listens to me, so we're going to have them in perpetuity. So let me actually ask you all the first question, which is, am I right to classify this State of the Union as basically a campaign speech? And more broadly, the unofficial official or the official unofficial start of the 2024 election, right? Now that Trump has basically wrapped up the Republican nomination, now that Biden has come out so forcefully in laying out his case for his reelection, is this the way we should view this particular State of the Union?
Yeah, I think that's clearly right. Biden didn't say Trump's name, but he did refer to, I think the language he used was my predecessor, or like some presidents multiple times, which had a little bit of a, like, you can't say his name, like Voldemort aspect to it. But as you say, I mean, it was very clearly aimed at contrasting himself with Trump and positioning Trump and the Republican Party as a threat to American democracy. And so in that respect, very, very clearly kind of the starting gun on the 2024 general election. I have to say, I also hate States of the Union. They're always really boring. This was a great speech, which are words that I genuinely don't know if I've ever said about words that have come out of Joe Biden's mouth.
But that's because it was like a stem winder of like an angry election speech, like, which makes for a much better speech than your average State of the Union.
Well, sure. But Biden is not like, he has his skills as a politician, right? Like it's actually, if you turned on the State of the Union before he started and then kept it on after the speech ended, you got a sort of glimpse into what Biden's real political skill is, which is that the man loves to talk to people. It took him like 20 minutes to get from the door to the podium. And then he was in, apparently, I did not watch the whole thing, but apparently he stayed in the chamber so long that the lights went out. Like, that man loves a rope line, but he has never been a super magnetic speaker. It's just not his forte, in part because of his stutter, in part because he's not a super articulate person when it comes to stringing words together. He's just not a great speaker, but like, this was a really good speech. It was passionate. It communicated what it needed to communicate. He clearly seemed to be having fun with it. I will say I found it pretty funny that like less than 24 hours, I think, after he gave this speech, there was a column from Ezra Klein that was kind of shamefacedly like, okay, maybe he's not too old anymore. Goodbye. Which, like, are you serious? Like that was all that you needed to convince you, my man? But I mean, I think that communicates it did what it needed to do, right? Which is it. So did it make any difference in the polling? No, the State of the Union never does. Not enough people watch it. Nobody cares. In terms of what it said to sort of, you know, the political class, the commentariat about Biden's readiness to get out there and campaign and his ability to deliver the message, I think it did a really he did a really good job, man. Like, I'm not used to being a cheerleader and an enthusiast for States of the Union, but like, it was just a good speech.
I agree. I also don't think you guys are selling States of the Union generally short. So let me come to their defense briefly.
I just want to say I am really impressed that you're all now saying States of the Union.
I don't know how State of the Unions. States. I
think, well, exactly. Yeah. It's not State of the Unions. It's one union, and there are many states of them every year. And so,
yeah, it's not like the states 50 of the states. Unions. It's the other states of the saying, union.
I'm proud that I got you all. I'm proud that I incepted that.
Yeah, I agree. No, I think I appreciate the grammatical accuracy. I mean, you know, this is a different from a campaign speech, although this one was also a campaign speech, right? It is a big concentrated block of time, more than if you're not Donald Trump, you usually get from any audience for political speech. Donald Trump, of course, like famously fills stadiums of people to listen to him ramble for an hour and a half at a time. That is kind of exceptional, even for presidential candidates, right? Barack Obama didn't pull that off very often when he's a candidate. I saw him talk a number of times that year in 2008, 2009, and like, you know, you did not get quite that much committed time. Here you get an incumbent president with a committed time where he's really, his target is usually Congress, actually, not, or the opposing party in Congress, not a opponent in a coming presidential election. Now, there's always a partisan dynamic because we have a two-party system and often we have split government. That's often a barrier to what a president wants to accomplish. But usually that is his main target. And in that sense, I actually think it's really useful because it's bringing a lot of, you know, kind of inter-party, very inside DC squabbling around legislation, legislative agenda, key items a little bit to the fore. I'm always surprised, frankly, the thing I'm always shocked by that is so consistently bad, which hopefully we'll talk about a little bit, is the aforementioned response responses, which are almost always terrible, have been particularly terrible the last few years. I do feel like Republicans are worse at them than Democrats. Maybe that's my bias, but I do feel like they tend to go worse for Republicans than Democrats. I will say I did
go back and rewatch the clip of Marco Rubio like furtively grabbing the water bottle, which is just an all-time great moment.
But that was amazing compared to Katie Britt. I mean, I'm just saying, like I remember when Marco Rubio's water bottle thing was like the most embarrassing response of all time. And like, that was nothing compared to this response.
It is bizarre to me that these are constant problems, because it should be a huge opportunity, right? Like, it should be something the opposing party should jumping on, the opportunity to have a rebuttal that gets a lot of national attention, not as much as the State of the Union, but it gets flubbed every year. And I cannot figure out why. And it's a clear strategic
It's because it's not problem. In front of a crowd. I think that's the problem. I think when you have the energy and the pageantry of the president, and then you have like some rando in a kitchen or an office, like it just like they need to. I mean, this is another reason why states of the union don't fundamentally make sense, right? Like, there is not enough unanimity in this country to justify one, and if there was, you wouldn't have a response. So just like, let the president make a campaign speech, and then let the other guys make a campaign speech, and just do it in two separate rooms or two separate crowds. Otherwise, it's kind of ridiculous.
But it's not usually a campaign speech. Usually, it's a debate between the branches and the people who control them, and that's useful. Here, it was more a campaign speech. A lot of that is because he can say his predecessor, right? Like, no other president in living memory has been able to do that and be able to say, oh, my predecessor, when he is president, who I'm also running against this time, did this. So Biden is in a uniquely advantageous position there. I frankly think if it were another new candidate who hadn't served in that office before, frankly, there'd be a lot fewer things for him to hit, because a lot of candidates at this point have fairly like broadly defined policy goals. Like, there's a couple things they could pick him out off on, but it'd be a lot less hay for him to make. He'd have to focus on more Republicans. So, you know, that's a general defense of the State of the Union. I think Biden clearly did strongly in this one. I think it was a really well-delivered speech. There were enough foibles and stuff that people who are really looking for reasons to be worried about his age will still find them, although some of that has always been just Joe Biden there. Really pushing it as long as he did, I thought, was really an interesting choice. Like, this was an endurance. This was a long State of the Union, as State of the Unions go. As I was watching it, I read along with these things with the script on the White House, because what gets ad hoc and ad-libbed is very interesting, and often, in this case, was some of the more problematic parts of it in terms of delivery. And the length they went on, I mean, I think Biden actually really did slow down and face more problems the last third of his speech, which is well over the hour mark. And that's understandable. I think I would feel the same way. And I think it's not unreasonable that an 81-year-old who might be totally able to serve as president effectively, nonetheless, after an hour of giving a speech, begins to have more verbal foibles and tics and loses a little bit of strength. That's, I think, natural, especially because he was clearly wrestling with a cold or something else that he was sniffling through and coughing through. But a key point being, like, I think there's a lot of value to these moments. I think they really contribute to the public discourse in a more substantive way than most campaign speeches do. There's a lot more policy in this, a lot more discussion of actual issues. And they set the agenda for what Biden is going to talk about and other people are going to have to talk about for this election and for this coming legislative and policy year. So I think there's a lot of value to that. And I thought the speech was an effective one, and it's worth digging into some of the actual policies that they were talking about.
So I do want to get into the content of the speech, but before I do that, I do want to kind of close the loop on the point Quintin raised, which is, you know, what this speech says about pervasive worries, I mean, which honestly have become almost sort of reached a kind of hysterical level in the past few weeks about Biden's age. One thing that I found very strange is I have never found the arguments about Biden's age all that compelling. He seems perfectly fine to me. I mean, a little low energy, but I'm not looking for a circus performer in my president. I mean, it seems perfectly
low
fine.
Low energy.
I mean, not like Alan low energy with the Trumpism. Jeb levels. low energy. No, no.
Did you not see the exclamation mark at the end of his name?
That's still good. That's good. I do miss Jeb.
Jeb.
I came into this not understanding the freak out everyone had over Biden's age, though, of course, the polling wasn't great. So maybe for that reason, I wasn't overly impressed with the delivery. I thought delivery was fine, but I guess I wasn't looking for him to exceed any particular standard already. And what I found very strange is it seems like we have a situation where the freak out has pushed expectations so low, not just among Republicans, but also among Democrats, because the Republicans are also piling on, you know, Sleepy Joe or whatever Trump calls him, that giving this speech, which again was fine, has oddly changed everyone's mind. And a perfect example is this, like, this Esther Klein column, which is so bizarre. Like, it took Joe Biden to be able to talk for like 90 minutes with a loud voice. Like, that's all you wanted?
Apparently.
I don't know. This all strikes me as bizarre. No, I mean, maybe good for Biden.
This is grist for my theory, which is that the pundit freak out about Biden's age, which is separate from the polling and the Republican attacks, was almost, let's say, 75 to 80% a creature of the fact that it was March and they didn't have anything to write about. And now the State of the Union happened and they can write about that. So you don't have to be worried about it anymore. But no, I mean, I do think that it was very telling that the Republican attacks on Biden during and after the speech, the response was he was too shouty or he was too loud.
Too high energy.
Rather than Sleepy Joe.
Yeah.
Which I think goes exactly to your point, Alan, that, you know, if you lower the bar that far, it's very easy to hop over it. I actually do think, you know, anyone who was genuinely worried, I think, would have found something to reassure them here. Again, it's weird for me to hear myself sounding like a super duper cheerleader for Joe Biden, but I do think that...
What a DNC hack you've become.
I know. And the other thing that's really interesting, so I, for my sins, spent a fair amount of yesterday, so Tuesday, watching the House Judiciary hearing with Special Counsel Robert Hur, and the question of the accuracy of Hur's comments on Biden's memory is a different conversation. I don't think reading the transcript of the interview that they were accurate. So the transcript has now been released. But it was very notable to me that the Republican line of attack was not, will you please tell me about how Joe Biden is old? Isn't Joe Biden old? Didn't Joe Biden have memory problems? It was, but what about Trump, selective prosecution, yada, yada, yada. Like that was not the line that they went with. Now, maybe they made that decision for other reasons, but I did find it notable and perhaps a suggestion that that critique is maybe not doing as much for the Republican Party as they would like it to be.
Well, and look, this particular race, as it's come down, we now very clearly know who the two nominees are going to be, barring something truly, you know, unprecedented happening between now and the summer.
Would you say that Nikki Haley can still pull this off, Scott?
Maybe. I don't know. We'll see what happens on the floor in July. The key point being, you know, it's different when you have an 80-year-old candidate running against a 77-year-old candidate, right? I don't know if that's the exact age split here. You know, Biden here really had to establish in optics of capability, because I think the concern a lot about this and the way it may be impacting the polls, I'm not convinced this is like the key thing driving bad polling numbers for Biden, is like this idea of this kind of meta idea that, oh, he's just not up to the task. He's weak or he's older and things like that. And this speech really helps to address that meta narrative. Does it actually address the underlying concerns about having an octogenarian president? No. And there are very reasonable concerns about that, because it's a really demanding job and running a campaign is very demanding. And there are reasonable arguments to say there's a reason all of the things being equal, maybe that's not the best way to go about it. I don't think those arguments mean you get rid of Joe Biden as a nominee. I think that's kind of foolish, and I don't think you really got there. But I think it's fair things to talk about as a genuine concern, something that the campaign and other people do have to plan around, and particularly those worried about like succession in government, right? The same is all that stuff is similar to true of a 77-year-old man running for president in the form of former President Donald Trump, who in many ways certainly seems like he might be in worse health than Joe Biden on a number of key metrics in that regard, diet alone. And so like on that perspective, I think having established the meta narrative and having a few representative things you can establish, it's harder for the Trump folks to really hit Biden over it, because, you know, a younger candidate might say, oh, let's do five 3-hour debates. And maybe you count on wearing down your opponent here. I don't think Trump can stand up for 5 3-hour debates, nor does it play to his strengths, right? Like, we all know that there's a good chance he's not going to engage in debates. He wasn't willing to engage in any with his Republican nominees. Maybe they'll have one, right? That's kind of where I suspect is headed at this point, is that we'll get one somewhat contained debate, and that's all that the two candidates will agree to. Same way with the pace of the campaign trail. Like, other candidates, maybe you could really aggressively hit swing states, hit lots of speaking. They're going to do that, but I suspect it's not going to be with the vigor and the pace of certain other candidates might. A lot more work through surrogates. And because you're both dealing with older candidates, it's just you don't have as much opportunity to take advantage of that. That's different than if there were a younger candidate in the mix on either side, I suspect.
So despite the pageantry and the horse race, we should actually talk about the content of it. You know, as usually with States of the Union, it was kind of a potpourri of random stuff. There was some notable national security things, the sort of stuff you would expect. I mean, started with a really full-throated defense of America's support of Ukraine and a criticism of Republicans for not providing sort of enough support. There was discussion about obviously the Israel-Hamas war, the Israel-Gaza war, and Biden talking about creating a U.S.-led, I'm not sure exactly what to call it, a kind of temporary port in Gaza for the transshipment of relief supplies, raises its own interesting legal and policy issues that I hope we can talk about at some point in the future. Some discussion about Houthis, and then also a real hammering of Republicans for supporting and then immediately flip-flopping on the border security bill after Trump concluded, probably correctly from a political perspective, that giving Biden a win would not help his chances, Trump's chances, that is, of winning in 2024, and then leading to this border security bill that Republicans had supported, then being sunk by Republicans. This then, of course, led to a exchange, off-the-cuff exchange with Marjorie Taylor Greene, in which Biden used the word illegal to talk about a illegal immigrant who had killed a U.S. woman. This led then to some back and forth the next day about whether that was appropriate or not in terms of Biden using that term. But anyway, that's sort of the main national security issues and topics that came up in the speech. I can't say I find anything terribly interesting there. Obviously the announcement, though I don't know if Biden announced that in the speech of the U.S. Gaza relief effort, or if that had been announced before.
It was leaked before, but
it was leaked before, but it was the first announcement. So that first was interesting. Public announcement. That was interesting. Everything else, pretty standard. I'm curious what you all thought.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I think those are the Gaza and Ukraine points are the big one, with the border kind of playing in there as well. Although, that struck me as a kind of predictable political angle we've already seen getting played up, rightfully, though. You did see Republicans flip on the border and their demands in that regard, and they should take some lumps over that. Opening with Ukraine is a pretty bold move, I think, for Biden. It means he's running as a foreign policy president. Insofar as this is him making his case for re-election, he's saying a big part of my legacy is that just as FDR stood up to Nazis in Europe, I'm standing up to Russia in Ukraine.
Good luck with that. That's, politically.
That's the challenge, right? Like, he's really attaching a lot of himself to this legacy and going for it when it's one that is facing a lot of pushback on the Hill. And also, there's a bit of a trade-off there. Like, does politicizing something, making it so personal, hurt or help it when you really need bipartisan support for it? Like, are you going to get Republicans, perhaps some Republicans, I think many of them would not feel this way. Maybe some Republicans would say, well, I'm more hesitant to support Ukraine over this because I don't want to give Biden a win. I kind of think that was unavoidable. Like, it's so tight. Ukraine policy is so tied up with Biden and his administration. I think that was going to be the reality regardless. But there is a little bit of a double-edged sword here in regards when the president really owns a policy and makes it a focus. But nonetheless, I mean, he very clearly is running on a foreign policy success in pushing back against Russia. China, very few mentions throughout the speech. Really, Russia being the main focus of everything in this regard and the main foreign policy focus. Other foreign policy items really shoved to the end of the speech. Still important, but where you deal with a lot more technical and problematic, complicated policies. Ukraine being up front, I think, is really notable. The Gaza bit is interesting because it's just clearly the administration is pivoting on Gaza. And we already knew this because we've seen a lot of action happening in the kind of policy circles between sanctions, between meetings with Benny Gantz at the White House, stuff we've talked about last few weeks on the podcast. But here he really made it public. But it was a kind of a softer pivot than some people might have been expecting. And frankly, than a lot of administration officials have been signaling through the media. This was a Israel, you really got to come along with us, and we're not waiting for you. We've got to do something that's humanitarian. It wasn't painting Israel as an obstacle. It was painting Israel as perhaps negligent in keeping up with this issue. And those are two different narrative points. And frankly, certain senior administration officials have been much more frank that Israel is being an obstacle in discussions in regards to aid delivery, in discussions with the media. That's not unusual to hear different tacks pursued by different parts of the executive branch, both naturally and strategically. And Biden, I think, frankly, as somebody who really, as he said during the speech, has been a longtime backer of Israel, has very strong pro-Israel credentials, was never going to was always going to find a way to try and keep the door open with Israel a little bit, but maybe not with Bibi Netanyahu. But it is notable, and it gives the administration maybe a little bit more effort to wind up itself in this policy. And it may also be a clear response to the fact that, we've seen it perhaps hurting him politically in the Michigan primary and other places, in that the Democratic base is not excited about his Gaza policy. And so this is clearly an effort to square that circle, but it's hard, it's complicated, and that's why you find it at the end of the speech. It's not the success story you want to open with.
I will say I was also struck by that decision to open with Ukraine. I was particularly struck by how Biden then used that to transition into a discussion of democracy at home and January 6th. And I do think that that is a connection that has not been made enough. You know, there are a lot of threads that you can identify between sort of a fledgling Ukrainian democracy attempting to protect itself against a far-right Russian state trying to crush it, and the United States, which is a mature democracy now struggling with a sort of far-right insurgency from within. I think you can make a very strong argument that these are certainly not the same conflict, but they're instances in which democracies should stand together and understand themselves as sort of arrayed together against a, I don't know whether it's rising anymore, but threat of far-right populism. And I found it very powerful how Biden connected those two things, and actually, like, kind of gutsy. I don't think that we've seen that connection made. Perhaps, and I should also say, shout out here to Benjamin Wittes, who's made this point before about drawing a connection between those two things. I do think perhaps, you know, it does add to the politicization of the issue in the way that you set out, Scott, not only because, you know, affective polarization in the United States is such that if you say January 6th, Republicans are immediately going to be against whatever you say next if you frame that as a bad thing. But I do think it's an important point. And frankly, House Republicans are at this point largely arrayed against American democracy, and they're arrayed against democracy in Ukraine too, by systematically blocking aid to a country that's under attack and needs U.S. support. So I found that very compelling.
Well, talking about events on Capitol Hill, we have heard some other rumblings about things that happened earlier today, Wednesday, March 13th, as we were recording. The House passed the TikTok bill. This is a bill that would essentially force TikTok to close in the United States, no longer be available on app stores and other measures or other venues where it might be available as of this fall, if I believe. I think it's September would be the implementation date. If its owners, ByteDance, Chinese owners, do not divest from it. This is the perhaps end of the road, or at least the latest step in a long conversation we've been having around this company. It started with former President Trump banning the company, using certain delegated authority to him during his presidency. But strangely, former President Trump, when it comes to this legislation, appears to have recently changed positions, came out in opposition to the legislation shortly after meeting with some people who may or may not have been investors in it, in a kind of strange about face that he's having a little trouble explaining the exact justification behind. Meanwhile, we know the Biden administration has been engaged in conversations with TikTok for months, years now, actually, I think literally years, through the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States and other authorities that have threatened at various points to force TikTok to divest from certain U.S. investments and other people to divest from TikTok. In particular, there's a focus on the acquisition of a affiliated U.S. social media company, as I recall. That's kind of the jurisdictional hook for CFIUS in particular. But that strangely has never come to anything, at least not yet. We haven't seen any concrete efforts to really force TikTok's owners to take that action. Instead, they've proposed different solutions to walling off U.S. users' data in various ways that the administration does not and others have not found fully satisfactory yet. We don't know the fate of this bill, but we do know current President Biden has said he will sign it if it comes to his desk. So at this point, the only question is the Senate, where it was recently endorsed by the Senate Intelligence Committee, or at least a measure along these lines was endorsed by it, meaning divestment, meaning the bill seems to have strong odds there. So there's a very good chance it or something that looks a lot like it is going to find its way into federal law. Alan, let me turn to you on this. What do you make of this bill? First off, let's just talk about what it actually does and what it will accomplish. Are there legal barriers? We know former President Trump, when he tried to bar TikTok using the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, encountered judicial pushback, actually had a rare loss in using that authority before the federal courts that prevented him from doing so. Do we expect or might we expect a similar issues to come up in the context of this bill? And what does that say about how the administration or Congress might approach it moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that doing this through legislation is definitely legally wiser than trying to do this through executive order. You know, one of the reasons that Trump lost in trying to ban both TikTok and I think WeChat as well, another Chinese communications app, is because under IEPA, which is the statutory authority that it gives him, that gives the president these emergency economic authorities, there's actually a carve out for information I forget exactly what it is, but basically for kind of information flows and those sorts of things. I think so. The Berman, am I getting that right? The Berman Amendment, or
correct?
I think it's what it is. Yeah. So it just was not within the president's unilateral power to do so. Obviously, with Congress, that problem goes away. Now, there are still legal issues. There's some concern over whether this might be a bill of attainder, which is not something you hear about too often. But, under the Constitution, Congress is not permitted to pass what are called bills of attainder. These are basically punishments of individuals or of individual entities by Congress. That was something that was actually abused quite a bit in pre-revolutionary England and in the colonies. And so it's one of these things that gets in the Constitution. I think there are good arguments that this is not a bill of attainder. This is not a punishment. This is not just about TikTok. So I think there are ways around that. But that's probably going to be something that, I would imagine TikTok's lawyers would raise in any sort of lawsuit or attempt at an injunction. I think more serious, though I still think survivable, is going to be the First Amendment issues. These also were part of the reason that Trump failed. And obviously Congress can no more than the president violate the First Amendment. And the concern here, obviously, is that TikTok is a huge social media platform. It's used by millions and millions of Americans. It's an important forum for communication. There's no question, therefore, I think that a ban of TikTok, or let's be clear here, a requirement of divestment that could lead to a ban, right, would implicate First Amendment issues. I think there are ways of getting around that. But I suspect that it's the First Amendment issue that will probably get the most play. And it would not surprise me, honestly, if you could find a judge somewhere, right, to enjoin this law. So, I do think that, what we're probably going to see is if this law is passed, and it looks like more likely than not it will be, and President Biden has said he would sign it, is that it will be enacted. It will then be immediately challenged. Probably you will find some district court judge to enjoin the law on First Amendment grounds, and we'll get at least a circuit court opinion, though maybe a Supreme Court opinion. This strikes me as the sort of, the Supreme Court has shown itself very interested in these platform First Amendment issues, and this would certainly not be a waste of the Supreme Court's time. But you asked me about the legal issues. I mean, I do want to just say, I think this is a good bill. At the end of the day, it's not like my vote matters, but I think this is the right call, to be honest. I think at the end of the day, it is crazy to allow a adversary totalitarian power control over a huge swath or a very important swath of the information space in one's country. And again, while I think the First Amendment issues are real and they need to be worked through, I think this is one of these situations in which the real national security imperatives just override what again are legitimate First Amendment concerns. And I think it's important also just to be clear about what the real policy stake here is. I think one thing that's unfortunate is I think the messaging around this bill and just generally the TikTok bans or whatever has gotten a bit muddled, because often it's sold as a kind of anti-surveillance measure, or specifically about U.S. data privacy. You don't want the Chinese to be able to access data on TikTok users. I mean, that's not wrong. The problem with those kinds of arguments is that they ring quite hollow given the general state of data protection in the United States, which is very bad. And so, the rejoinder there is always, well, okay, I mean, you're banning TikTok on that basis. That's not going to stop the Chinese from just buying the data on the open. Like, if the Chinese want this data, they're going to find this data. They're going to buy this data because of how lax American data privacy laws generally. I find that a pretty compelling rejoinder, which is why I think that, the better argument is just, look, I just don't want the Chinese Communist Party in charge of, one of the nation's most important social platforms, especially one that's very popular with young people, and especially one that is entirely algorithmically curated, like even more so than other platforms, which again, therefore gives the owners a huge disproportionate influence on what people see. I would just say that. And if that means this is a content-based or even a viewpoint-based restriction that therefore has to survive strict scrutiny, right? I would just own that. Right, the Supreme Court has many times been willing to limit foreign access to, U.S. information or the U.S. information space and U.S. political process, and I don't see why they shouldn't be willing to do that here as well.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So before I give my view, I should say I don't want to get too far out ahead of our skis because it's not clear what will happen to this bill in the Senate, but it is whatever happens, it will not happen quickly. Let me put it like that. Schumer's office has said that they will review it when it arrives in the Senate, which is not exactly like a super thrilled vote of confidence. So who knows? This may go absolutely nowhere. Remember when everyone was really excited because the Senate accidentally banned daylight savings and then that never went anywhere?
I did.
That was a great moment.
This seems a little different than that.
No. I'm just saying I want to be clear that, like, as with COSA, right, which seems like it has a lot of steam in the Senate and it's totally unclear what will happen in the House, this has now passed the House and it is totally unclear what will happen in the Senate. So I just want to, like, put that on the table. Look, TikTok likes to say it is not controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. What they mean by that is that ByteDance, which owns it, is nominally an independent company. However, functionally, because it is a company in China, that means that the CCP has just an enormous amount of control over what ByteDance does and has a lot of ability to, you know, fiddle with all the levers and make the algorithm do this and that. If you recall, there was I can't keep track of the scandals, but there was an incident a few years ago where it basically turned out that material where people mentioned Uyghurs was being systematically downranked, right? So there is a lot that makes me uncomfortable about that. That said, it is also true that the concerns about TikTok are, it seems to me that a lot of times people just stop there without setting out what are the actual policy, like what is, how do you go from A, which I just set out, to B, like the specific concern, and then C, how your proposed policy will actually address that issue. Like, is the problem data privacy? Is the problem manipulation of the algorithm? Like, what is the issue? And I do think that, I'm not saying that there aren't issues there. I'm just saying that I think there's a lack of clarity. And I also think that a better way to deal with this problem that wouldn't run into the same amount of First Amendment scrutiny would just be to pass comprehensive federal privacy legislation. Please, for the love of God. It would fix so many things. It would prevent not only TikTok, but also, like, data brokers, other big platforms that are based in the US, which you maybe also don't want to have all of your data, from accessing this information. And I think that the reason that that hasn't happened is, A, it's, like, technically just very difficult to do for a lot of sort of specific legal reasons. And B, it's not politically sexy in the same way. You know, there's a kind of surge of political interest around this, in part seemingly because TikTok sent people a pop-up suggesting that they call their member of Congress and lobby them against the bill, which seems to have backfired. Although, you know, it's getting the youth involved in politics, which we always want, right? You know, the word TikTok, the word CCP, that gets people very excited when, once you start talking about, you know, federal data privacy legislation, they maybe fall asleep and they're not so interested. It's harder to spin in a sort of sexy and exciting way. But I ultimately just feel like there are so many issues that would just be addressed by going the really boring plodding route and steering away from a higher profile, but narrower and perhaps ultimately unconstitutional legislation.
But that assumes that the problem is the data privacy point. So
I guess, so what do you see as the other difficulty?
Yeah, so I want to be very clear, right? I don't think the data privacy point is very compelling.
Okay.
I just don't, right?
Unless and until we get export restrictions on data
which is something the Biden administration issued an executive order for last week that's working towards. Okay, yeah. So in a few years, it may be more compelling. It's not currently.
Well, but it's not just that. It's because of the point Quinta made, right? It's because, like, you can phrase this policy-wise or you can phrase this in First Amendment language, right? But under-inclusive policy action is a problem, right? If you're going to take down an entire platform and you're not going to move the needle much on the underlying problem, like, that is itself an issue, right? So I really totally agree with you, Quinta, right? But you could bracket all of those issues, right? And still, you have to squarely confront, right? You can think of it as a policy issue, as a First Amendment issue, right? Are you willing to ban a major platform, right, in order to avoid the risk of the Chinese Communist Party having control over, you know, a major information algorithm in the United States, right? And, you know, I'd be willing to do that, but I think that trade-off is inescapable. Right. Hmm. And you know, the reason I focus on that is just because, like, that's what I think the interesting part of this discussion is. But I grant you everything that, like, as with any legislation, there's always, like, weird messaging and you fight on different fronts and it's not perfect. But, like, that to me is the intellectually interesting part of this debate.
So, you know, the part that I'm curious about, that, 'cause I find this compelling objectively. I don't like the idea of a potential adversary or a strategic competitor like China. I think calling them an enemy goes too far, and I don't think we want to lean in that direction, right? But somebody who, you know, we know has contrary interests to the United States and may have a vested interest in how our political system and elections operate, for example, and the outcomes of them, would have control over a major social media platform that reaches a lot of people. I get that. I get those concerns. I wonder what it means in an era where we have so many more integral services, not just in the political communication space, that are going to be digitized. And potentially then the question becomes, like, well, do we not tolerate foreign interest in things? But in some ways, we have a legal regime that's supposed to deal with this. That is the CFIUS regime, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. So why haven't we seen the Biden administration do something like this? Steps like this were already well within the control of the executive branch. Maybe there are some technical details about, because again, my understanding is that the CFIUS hook, the clearest one, is the acquisition of a U.S. tech company that's like, because it's primarily designed around acquisition, it's foreign investment. So that's like the hook. But they have the ability to unwind a lot of this stuff already. There's no Berman Amendment to CFIUS like there is in the IEPA context. That was a barrier for Trump. And it's not clear even that was necessarily insurmountable, but it was an issue that was not adequately addressed in the district court. So, Alan, let me, you know, why did the Biden administration not take action on this? And is that a sign that, well, maybe it's not as clean cut a policy issue as folks on the Hill may be making it out to be?
So that's one possibility. You know, I think the CFIUS issue is a tricky one for a couple of reasons. You know, one is the CFIUS hook would be the acquisition by TikTok of, and I forget the name of the company, but it's like Musical.ly or something. It's some US music company, because TikTok runs on music or something like that. So, you know, you could unwind that transaction, I guess, but that still wouldn't solve the underlying problem, right? Which is TikTok in the United States, right? That's the issue. And CFIUS can't prevent that problem, right? CFIUS cannot ban a Chinese or foreign platform from operating in the United States. That's not what CFIUS does. So one possibility might just be that CFIUS is not the right tool for this job, given that the concern is not TikTok buying a US asset. It's not that Musical.ly is of strategic value, right? Like, this is not like when some foreign company, you know, buys a US oil field or steel mill or something like that, right? So the one possibility might be that CFIUS is not the right tool here. The other possibility, and here I want to point everyone to this really, really good Law Review article by Ganesh Sitaraman, who's at Vanderbilt. This is in the Stanford Law Review article from a few years ago, and we'll link it, where he really thinks through this issue of foreign control of platforms in the United States, and is quite critical of that. And he argues that, you know, one of the reasons why what you want is a regime that's much more sort of sector-based and kind of bright line-based. Like, if you want to operate a platform in the United States, you must be a U.S. person or a U.S. entity or something like that. Is because, as he notes, the way that CFIUS things like Team Telecom and other related types of entities in the United States, the way they tend to work is they try to structure transactions in these clever ways that allow the transaction to continue but deal with the national security risk, which sounds like a good idea. But in practice, it often does not work very well, because you end up with situations where it's like, okay, CFIUS will allow such and such transaction if the foreign entity agrees to allow for certain kinds of monitoring by the US government and site visits and certain kinds of very clever internal safeguards with this data hived off from that data. Again, all of which in theory sounds good, but in practice, like it just doesn't end up being followed through very well. It creates a huge regulatory burden, a huge compliance burden, a huge oversight burden on behalf of the US. And so what Ganesh argues, and I think this is right, is you just have to have some brighter line rules, as have been the case in many industries across US history, where if you want to play in a particular space in the United States, you just have to be US, right? Like Rupert Murdoch became a US citizen, right? On his path to, you know, owning right-wing media. I'm not sure that worked out perfectly, but, you know,
that's an example. Really fixed the problem, didn't it?
Maybe. Yeah. I'm not sure the problem with Fox News is that it's owned by an Australian.
Well, no. But I think that is a good example here. Like, there are genuine issues with TikTok. Like, I don't want to deny that. But the idea that banning TikTok or forcing a sale, whatever, will sort of like fix the problem, I worry slots into a strain of argument that I find very worrying, that sort of frames like US good, non-US bad. And there's a lot more going on here. It is genuinely more complicated, but it seems hard to me to deny that a lot of this is motivated by, frankly, outright xenophobia against China. And alarm that there is a dominant tech platform that is not US based. There's a little bit of kind of, you know, declining power angst happening. And also, you know, and to the Murdoch point, right? There is plenty of harm wrecked in the media ecosystem and on social media by people who are firmly within the US political system. See Elon Musk. So I don't know. I go back and forth. I feel like I'm often like such a negative Nancy about all tech legislation that I should say like, this is not, there's a lot of really stupid stuff out there. And I don't think that this is in that category. I'm just not sure it's the best way to solve the problem. How's that?
So before we move on to this topic, we should talk about the position taken by not the current president, but a past president, and perhaps once in future
his predecessor,
former President Trump. Up until about a week ago, I think most of us would have thought former President Trump was one of the staunchest and most vocal enemies of TikTok. After all, his administration, amidst many other actions targeting aspects of Chinese activities in the United States and around the world, and upping the rhetorical heat with China, particularly, as I mentioned, pursued those legal actions, albeit problematic ones from a legal perspective, that tried to ban TikTok the first time around. The Biden administration didn't discontinue those and has been engaged in this long conversation, but has not pursued similar steps. Those kind of threatened to do once or twice. Yet a week ago, former President Trump seemed to have a meeting with an individual who is financially involved with TikTok and came out of it saying, I'm not a supporter of the TikTok ban legislation, saying he didn't want to alienate a bunch of young people in advance of the election who would freak out. Which I think is really interesting. I have a take on this, but I want to hear what you all think about this. Like, what is Trump responding to? What explains this behavior that he himself has struggled to explain exactly
money.
What this flip-flop is?
It's the money, yeah. Scott.
This is the least subtle. I mean,
he's a man of deeply held principle.
look, as someone once told me, I have principles, but it's not like, you know, I have to answer to them. They serve me, not the other way around. I mean, he's just a kleptocrat. Like, he's just a con man.
There's not even anything to discuss.
None of this is sophisticated. And it's just, look, what's entertaining is not the Trump flip-flop. Like, that's so predictable, whatever. He just needs money. He doesn't give a shit about anything. What's entertaining is watching this, like, Republican establishment now try to, in real time, kind of contort itself seven-dimensionally so that it can both, you know, stand up for what it used to say it believed in and what I think it actually believes in, but also pay fealty to Dear Leader. And it's I don't know if there's anything all that interesting to say, except it's just, it's a hell of a thing to watch.
So I don't deny that might be part of it. I want to say it's slightly more complicated than that. I think there's a different motivation here that's not just money, although I think that's part
of
it.
Both
sides Anderson. Well, it may be worse. I think I actually may be painting a less flattering picture to some extent. Because Trump, the one thing we learned is that Trump is not great at filtering. And he often just tells you what he's doing and why he's doing it pretty straightforwardly. And he basically said, I don't want to alienate all these kids before the election. Like, to me, it strings very clearly. He's worried about people getting pissed off about ending TikTok, and he's trying to cater to TikTok users. And it's interesting, this all happening around a moment that's actually a pretty notable one for Trump, which is this big rapprochement with the Club for Growth. Like, yes, the like billionaire Republican mega donor, as he's being described in the media. Like, I actually am not sure. I've seen reports that he is like individually giving tons of money directly to Trump campaign, although that very well may happen. He's a big donor generally to particularly the business friendly Republican causes, and particularly to Club for Growth, where I think he's really involved, is my understanding. And we've just seen Club for Growth, which I think is generally skeptical of big regulatory moves like this, kind of come back under into Trump's camp after having spending several years in the wilderness, in part over objections to Trump's more populist economic policy. So I think those factors may be into this as well. Like, I think there may be actually reflecting a bigger sense of political triangulation than just a money grab here, particularly because it's not clear the money has been deposited yet. I don't think that makes it any less mercenary, but I do think it makes it a little more interesting and maybe like a little more a sticking power. Like, maybe it's a sign of Trump shifting a little bit his coalition to try and bring in some of the big money conventional Republicans in, maybe as a reaction to the fact that they backed Nikki Haley and other candidates during the primary, and he wants to bring them in more fully in to give shift their fundraising streams to him before the general. I don't know why, but I just think it's a more complicated story than a lot of like the media coverage has drummed up on this so far. That's my suspicion, but we'll see where it goes from here.
Well, it'll last as long as it takes for him to decide that he needs to be tough on China and he wants to ban it now.
Yes, that is the question. Like, that's what I want to see, how quickly he flops back to his original flip.
There will be a flop.
Yes.
Well, let's move south a bit into the Caribbean and talk about the situation in Haiti, which has gone from bad to worse to, frankly, kind of apocalyptically bad in ways that are quite difficult to untangle. So for those who have been following, there's been a sort of prolonged political crisis over the last 3 years after the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse, which left the country, I believe, with no constitutionally confirmed leaders. A person named Ariel Henry was sort of slotted into the acting prime minister and acting president role. He's been in charge since then, but in the last few months, really, there's been increased trouble with gangs, which are gang really kind of undersells it. It's really sort of a, you know, free floating group of people who are attempting to hold political power on their own by wielding violence, taking over Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti, and challenging Henri's authority. Henri left the country to go to Kenya to negotiate an agreement that would involve Kenyan forces arriving in Haiti to help counter the gangs while he was out of the country. I believe he was blocked from returning. He's now in Puerto Rico and has agreed to resign under pressure from the United States. There's an agreement to reach a kind of transitional council government that would hold power, but it's deeply unclear whether or not that will actually happen because, again, gang leaders, including someone with a very pleasant nickname, Barbecue, sort of have de facto control over the country at this point. Scott, I want to situate this a little bit. Like I said at the beginning, I think that there's kind of often a sense in U.S. circles that, you know, really since the earthquake and the in the aughts, you know, Haiti has been a mess and Haiti is now a mess. And, you know, what else is new, to put it as sort of as callously as possible? That is not what this is, right? Like, this is way worse than that.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, that is true. Like, Haiti has been plagued by cyclical political instability and domestic violence of various stripes, sometimes state-sponsored, increasingly in recent years, relating to these criminal gangs, which is underselling exactly what they are. Like, in many cases, they are close to paramilitary organizations because of their level of armament and coordination. Several are headed up by former police officers and military individuals involved in the military. So, like, they are much more sophisticated than just, like, what you might think of as a street gang. But regardless, you know, that is true. But this is a crisis that approaches nothing like Haiti's ever dealt with before, in part because it's been going on for several years now without a clear response from the international community, despite pleas by the incumbent government, for one, as dating back to at least 2022, where they asked for a degree of international intervention to aid them in various ways from the United States or from the international community. By reports we're seeing, we have 20,000 internally displaced people roughly in Haiti. That number is a few months old, maybe even higher now at this point. People are being shot in the streets and killed without anyone able to take the bodies away because crossfire is too dangerous. There are no public services in major parts of Port-au-Prince and the city. We've seen kind of shifting coalitions of these street gangs, which again are like borderline paramilitary groups, where they have successfully raided a prison, freeing hundreds of people who are imprisoned in a move that really reminds me of, frankly, Iraq in the lead up to the ISIS kind of offensive in 2014. That was a signature move of ISIS early on, was breaking people out of prison to boost their
That's really encouraging.
Crews.
Thank you.
It's highly upsetting. It is like when you see prisons getting raided in paramilitary fashion and liberated to, you know, get more street soldiers, essentially, or foot soldiers for a particular movement, it's really, really dangerous. And that's what's happening here. We also have seen coordinated efforts to do things like take over the airport in Port-au-Prince by these gangs. That's an incredibly, incredibly dangerous and sophisticated thing for them to do. It reflects what their strategy has been, which is to try and dominate more and more inputs into Haiti, flows of aid, flows of assistance, flows of commerce, so that they can control it and dominate it in the kind of decentralized fiefdom fashion. It's incredibly dangerous. It means that you don't have any sort of clear mechanism to be able to establish any sort of interagency process or any sort of governmental process, because not sure clear how much of the government matters, because there aren't any tools of government that clearly can begin to enforce the law or push it back against these mechanisms. You have incredibly beleaguered and in many cases kind of compromised with sometimes with complicated relationships with some of these groups, federal police force and other police forces. It's just an incredibly, incredibly difficult picture, and there's no clear, easy way out. That's why you've seen at least the incumbent government push for some sort of external intervention, which the UN has been negotiating now for over a year. The opposition is cooler on the idea. I think a lot of people are concerned that Henri is just going to use it as a means of staying in control. But just in the last 24 or 48 hours, he has agreed to step down at the point where they establish some sort of interim transitional government. So that might help assuage some of those concerns and be seen as a way to build political support around some sort of an external intervention. But the thing to bear in mind is the intervention we're talking about is not like the ones we've seen in the past. We're talking about 1,000 Kenyan police officers who are expected to arrive, I think, substantially later this year. I think an initial group of like 100 or 200 is going to arrive, maybe has already begun to arrive in these first few months to do some on-the-ground planning and coordination, and the rest is not going to arrive till later. But it's just a much smaller intervention than we've seen in the past. When the United States intervened in Haiti in 1994, it sent 20,000 troops. That was a very different measure. That was in anticipation of potential regime change, essentially, but kind of regime return in the form of the Aristide government. So you were dealing with military targets, things along those lines. But again, these are huge gangs with major paramilitary capabilities in control of dense urban areas. 1,000-man police forces, it strikes me as a big challenge for them to significantly change the facts on the ground for what this is going to do. So it's just a really difficult situation. And it's not clear to me what the right policy approach coming out of this moment is at this point.
I think you're as usual being more polite than you should be. I mean, no offense to Kenyan police, you know, police officers, but this is a joke intervention, right? I mean, what Haiti needs is nation building, right? It needs a prolonged multi-year exercise in extremely on the ground, you know, build a country back from nothing, nation building. And that makes everyone extremely uncomfortable, right? And as it should, right? It makes the U.S., which would be the obvious candidate to do it, given where Haiti is geographically, very uncomfortable because it doesn't want to do it. And because the history of it doing it in the last 20 years, right, see Iraq and Afghanistan have worked out very poorly. It makes lots of other people very uncomfortable because of the ideological and colonial associations with nation building, especially given Haiti's history and the sort of traumas it's been through since its founding. But none of that changes the fact that you're dealing with a complete and total social and political collapse that needs reconstruction from the ground up. And, you know, it is unfortunate that we have botched the nation building, especially in Iraq, so badly, because this would have been the sort of situation where having some both self-confidence in our own capabilities and some international goodwill would have been very useful to deploy, but we don't have any of those things. And there seems to be exactly zero constituency in the United States for doing anything that would be very meaningful in Haiti. And so, unfortunately, I don't see any reason to think that anything will change, and this will just become, you know, a utterly failed state occupying one half of the island of Hispaniola.
So there's an interesting article in the New York Times opinion section by Lydia Pulgreen, who was back in the day a reporter on the ground in Haiti, essentially making the argument that part of the reason why we're in this situation to begin with is not just the assassination of Moïse, but the fact that when Henri came into power, there was sort of an expectation among Haitian civil society groups, which do exist, right? Like, there's not a total power vacuum here, that Henri would be kind of a caretaker figure and that there would then be negotiations among these civil society groups to kind of create a new Haitian government. But part of what happened is that the U.S. continued to support Henri, and thus we are now where we are. And Paul Green's argument essentially is right. Like, there needs to be, the Haitian state needs to be built back up. I think I'm accurately characterizing her argument, but that part of what that has to look like is there has to be a central role for Haitian civil society organizations, because this habit that the U.S. has of kind of coming in, installing a new government, leaving, getting fed up with the government, installing a new government, leaving, is not working. And the way I read her argument, at least, is that, and here's the, I'll just read the line. At a certain point, the belief that outside powers are manipulating your country becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, sowing paranoia and suspicion at precisely the moment the trust and solidarity are most needed. And so that, you know, part of what needs to be done is there needs to be just a huge infusion of assistance of all kinds for these civil society organizations to help rebuild from the ground up. That is a very optimistic vision. I don't think reading the article, Pulgreen thinks it's particularly likely, but it did strike me as an interesting take on the situation.
Look, I mean, it would be great if that were true, right? It'd be great if what Haiti needed, right, was a big infusion of support to civil society. I am skeptical of that, not because of anything about Haiti, right, but because of historically what it has taken to stabilize countries at this level of chaos, right? The United States occupied Japan after World War II and just ran that society for a long time, right? The Allies occupied Western Germany and ran that society for a long time. Not decades, right? But they didn't go in and support Japanese civil society, right, after World War II. Or they did, but like that was not the main way that you transformed Japan into the modern nation that it is today. Obviously, the situation is different, right? We're not at war with Haiti, right? We can't just invade Haiti just because we want to, right? But my point is that historically, right, the process of nation building is a much more top down, I'm not sure coercive necessarily the right phrase, but paternalistic certainly. I mean, are there counterexamples here?
Is there a positive example other than Germany and Japan?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a very specific situation.
I'm not right? sure there are positive examples, but that may mean that, unfortunately, this is very hard to do and you can't do
here's
it.
Here's a question. Here's a genuine question. So Germany did not have a civil society because the Nazis had crushed it. Was there a civil society in Japan? Like, I actually don't know if these two things are comparable because those were nations that have been flattened, in some cases, literally by war, whereas this is a situation where there are existing organizations.
But they may be existing organizations, but you have a situation where even civil society, right? Civil society are not the people walking around with guns, right? Like you have such a level of breakdown of basic, you know, the ability of the state to have the monopoly on force within its, you know, jurisdiction, right? Kind of Weberian sovereignty in the most fundamental sense, that the issue is not that you shouldn't support Haitian civil society. The problem is that folks who have generally been very skeptical of the heavy-handedness of American intervention in the past, I think underestimate just how heavy-handed any effective intervention would have to be, right? And would cause a lot of the same problems that it was in the past. That's the point I'm trying to make here.
So I think part of the problem here is because of this like nation-building dialogue, which I think is a overly ambitious and ill-conceived concept, if I'm being honest. Like, I don't think there are many good examples of external nation building in world history, because governance is an incredibly difficult politically contextual, culturally and historically contextual activity involving complex social relations that are just hard to like force onto anyone. Germany and Japan are like weird cases, in part that did come after devastating wars, in which, by the way, the governments of both those states that did survive did surrender and voluntarily start cooperating with occupying forces, right? That doesn't mean that there aren't lessons to be drawn. There might be, but it's not there. But I think I agree with your broader general point, Alan, like stepping aside from nation building, right? We seem to act as if any sort of external military intervention automatically turns to nation building, or it turns to some very broad mission, or is supposed to provide some solution, whereas it is a failure if after an external intervention, the country is not, you know, an established democracy. That's never going to happen from any external intervention. That doesn't mean that there aren't certain other values and interests that can be advanced here. And here, I think the core one is, you know, a basic ability to have some degree of political stability and absence of violence in the public space in Haiti, right? I think this is something that actually, and particularly a military intervention, not a police intervention, actually could accomplish more effectively. At least there's good reason to believe that. And I think those are conditions under which a surge to civil society, if that's what you can persuade the international community to do, if that's what you think is right, could be a lot more effective, because civil society aren't the people who take guns. They need space. Civil society needs public space to be able to operate. And maybe that is a lower hanging fruit, more realistic schemed mission that people should engage in. But we're not able to have a dialogue about this. We're in this moment where the United States and a lot of the rest of the world has like intervention fatigue because of Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, the Clinton administration, the George H.W. Bush administration, to some extent, the George W. Bush administration, they pursued dozens of these little interventions. They wouldn't have hesitated for a second because they intervened in Haiti twice before, right? Kind of three times. And that's not even being contemplated here. And I think there's a good reason. Like, I'm skeptical of U.S. intervention in a lot of cases, but I think this is like one of those rare cases where like our allergy to it, the fact we're in a political moment where it's hard to have a conversation, where too many people automatically turn on that because of the associations with it, which again, rightful critiques of what's been done in the past, are having us overlook a situation where like this might be the right, or at least in a tool that could do this much more effectively. I think it's really telling, you know, Crisis Group, which is International Crisis Group, which is a group that I always read first on this stuff, and I think is very, very useful. You know, I don't always agree with them, but most of the time I do, and I think they're always worth reading. On this Haiti motion, they have kind of, as of January of this year, they basically said, yeah, we need an intervention as quickly as possible, this Kenya intervention. And yes, it would be ideal if it could have full agreement, because at the time they didn't have the agreement of the opposition. But we really can't wait for that. The situation is just too dire. They don't get into like whether this police intervention is preferable or better or likely to be as effective as a military intervention or something else. I kind of have my doubts about that. I have to ask, if this were a mission that were like Congress signed off on it, the UN Security Council signed off on it, there's no legal barrier, you check all the procedural democracy boxes, why this isn't something where it actually might be in the U.S. interests and the regional interests to actually do something like this, and that could do it much more effectively with, and, you know, save lives and maybe establish conditions for whatever political process have to come next. That's not nation building. That is like, you know, something a little less ambitious. But I wish there was space for more discussion about those sorts of toolkits, because instead we're at the other end of the pendulum swing where those options have been completely kind of blocked out by politics because of bad experiences of the past, when I think actually they're quite different. They can be differentiated quite easily. Well, folks, that brings us to the end of our time together this week. But this would not be Rational Security if we did not leave you with some object lessons to ponder over in the weeks to come. Alan, what do you have for us?
So I have a great podcast from WGBH, which is a public media station in Boston. It's called the Big Dig podcast. So those of you who know anything about Boston or have lived in Boston will know that the Big Dig is this infamous project, you know, the biggest, if not biggest, kind of highway improvement projects in American history, where basically Boston tried to take a bunch of highways that had cut through the city and put them underground. The project has finished. It was a success in that it finished, but it was just this massive, overpriced kind of boondoggle that had all these problems, but at the same time was a really important piece of infrastructure, and kind of the last big piece of infrastructure the United States has built, which is not great given how much infrastructure we have to do in the next, you know, 20, 30, 40 years for climate change and other goals. So this is just a really interesting podcast that really just goes through the history of, you know, what happened and what were the problems. It's really sophisticated. It's really well done. It treats everyone very fairly. I mean, it's just super, super interesting. And I don't know, I for some reason, I find like kind of anything infrastructure related just so, so interesting. Highly, highly recommend it.
Alan Rosenstein just ripping off Molly Reynolds' object lessons shamelessly.
Wait, did she already do this one?
Plugs while you were on Family Leave.
But this is good. Now our listeners know that they really, really need
they
to
really,
listen
really
to
mean,
it.
They really, really mean it, guys. Get in on this podcast. No,
now you know that I didn't listen to every single minute of Rational Security while I was away.
That's why we take notes. That's why I got to take notes on my leave, Alan. Quinta, what do you have for us this week?
I also have an outdated object lesson. Boom. You may have heard there's a movie out about Robert Oppenheimer last year. Well, I'm here to say I finally watched it. And
B plus?
Yeah.
Was Robert Downey Jr. the best
B+,
part?
A-.
No, so this, well,
no,
this
the
is,
best part
this
was
is,
Gary Oldman
this is my hot
as
take.
Harry Truman.
Oh, that totally agreed. This is my hot take. They should have cut the black and white frame story. It did absolutely nothing for the plot. Huge mistake. The pacing was all over the place. Great performance by Robert Downey Jr., yes, but it
the
completely-
The black and white part is the only thing that made it watchable. It's the whole point
dude,
of showing the other side
of
Oppenheimer.
At the
two-thirds mark, you're so wrong.
At the two-thirds mark, they realized that they have 5 hours of movie left and only an hour. And then they were just like, okay, here's what's going to happen. We're going to give this to Robert Downey Jr. He's going to act with a capital A, and he's going to summarize, and he's going to talk real fast. And it was just, it was a mess. I'm really, really sorry, Christopher.
Honestly,
Nolan.
that was the scene in the movie that made it all work. Look, it's not
no,
a perfect
what?
Movie.
That was the
but
point
I
where
think
the movie completely
crazy.
Fell apart. Okay.
Are you kidding? Okay, well, so clearly, in addition to Scott and my mukbang, we need to have a Quinta Allen cage match octagon movie recap.
We did not do an Oscars episode this year, which I'm still bummed out. I still want to do a movies podcast at some point, but this may have to wait.
I will say, given that I was a childhood resident of Princeton, New Jersey, I did appreciate that the scenes at the Institute for Advanced Study were clearly actually filmed at the Institute. I know those woods. I have stood where Kurt Gödel and Albert Einstein stood. They're very nice.
That's the sort of authenticity that Princetonians are always looking for scenes from Princeton. I have not seen the movie yet. All I know is that I did at one point like speed read or read at least chunks of American Prometheus, or maybe I listened to an audiobook. I can't honestly remember, which is the book I think the movie is primarily based on, right? I don't know if it's entirely directly based on that, but I think it's at least tied to it. What a horny man. What a man with a weird, horny life. I hope that gets enough shrift in the movie because it was really absurd. As I was flipping through, I was like, this guy.
People used to just be hornier, Scott. This was like back in the 20th century when anyone ever had sex. You know,
I thought Mad Men was always so ridiculous. I thought they were just like playing it up. But now
I don't
like,
think so.
I think they kind of got it.
I think there was just, it was a hornier time.
Oh my gosh. It's ridiculous. Well, for my object lessons...
Speaking of horny time.
Well, kind of, but I'm not going to get into it. My object lesson is going to be, it's going to be in your 30s because I left them this week and turned, the ripe old age of 40.
When was your birthday?
It was my birthday this past week. Well, I was trying to hide it, cause I didn't want to celebrate it.
Old man Anderson. How you feel?
But I had an object lesson. You know, I feel pretty much the same as I did before I turned 40, but I'll say this. Here's what I'm going to say. Cause I don't feel like you get enough love for it. The 30s was the best decade of my life so far. I loved it. I thought it was wonderful. Everybody talks about your teens and your 20s like they're great. I hated my teens. My 20s were meh. They were fine. But the 30s was great. You know, you get kind of established your relationships, established your career, established in your life. You feel a little more in control of things and confident things. And I loved it. And I don't know if the 40s are going to live up to it. I kind of don't think they can. But I'm optimistic. I have some things to look forward to, including a new baby coming soon. But yeah, I'll just say that to anybody in your teens and your 20s and in your 30s wondering, your 30s are great. Look, don't fear them. Love them, embrace them, and enjoy every minute you get with them because they'll be gone before you realize it.
I turned 38 in a few months, and I also think that my 30s were definitely the best decade so far. Quinta, you're like 12. What is your what's been the best decade for you so far?
I'm gonna keep my youthful air of mystery intact. Thank you.
I forget. Are you a younger millennial or an elder Gen Zer?
No, I'm firmly a young millennial.
Yeah, I'm like, okay.
Whatever. well, folks, that brings us, that note of resignation brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security is, of course, a production of Lawfare, so be sure to visit us at lawfaremedia.org for our show page with links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other phenomenal podcast series, including The Aftermath, now out in season 2. While you're at it, be sure to follow us on Twitter or X at RATL Security, and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. Also, sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. For more details, visit lawfaremedia.org/support. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Noam Osband of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. We are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patcha. On behalf of my co-hosts, Alan and Quinta, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.